It's been just 1 week since the 2019 legislative session convened, if you can believe it. Lawmakers and the Capitol Press Corps already have their work cut out for them with hundreds of bills filed. And if you're wondering why our team hasn't gotten to one brilliant idea or another, blame Mother Nature. The long-awaited legislation on water and the drought contingency plan hit legislators' desks last week. What does or doesn't it say? You're listening to The Breakdown. I'm your host, Katie Campbell, and we're kicking off this episode with water, 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 water. Reporter and H2O extraordinaire Carmen Forman is here with me today to help me tackle this very important topic. Carmen, let's dive right in, if you will. Give me the SparkNotes version of the DCP.
Even the SparkNotes version of DCP is long, so I'll try to tone it down even more than that. Lawmakers got briefings on Water 101 last week, and reporters got the exact same sort of Water 101 briefing as well. So I'll try to sort of just recap it real quick for you. The DCP is a multi-state agreement that Arizona has to sign on to. And the gist of the agreement is that Arizona is agreeing to take various cuts in its water usage from the Colorado River. But the other states are agreeing to similar such cuts, though they may not be exact from state to state. Arizona is unique, though, in that the legislature has to approve signing on to the drought contingency plan. And unlike the other six states that are a part of this agreement, Arizona is the only one that entrusts this duty to its legislature, which is either a really good thing or a really bad thing. You guys know how the legislature works. Lawmakers got their first look at legislation for signing on to the drought contingency plan and a number of other measures that relate to how Arizona is going to deal with signing on to the drought contingency plan. So there's sort of this Arizona-specific plan that deals with, once the state agrees to these cuts, where do the cuts come from? Who suffers? Who will get reimbursed either in money or water from other sources for taking these cuts and for agreeing to take these cuts sometime over the next 6 to 7 years until the DCP is effectively null and void. So early drafts of the legislation were kind of put together by the Department of Water Resources. I've heard that legislative council is now sort of taking a look and working on their own sort of drafts. And not only did lawmakers get copies of the draft legislation, members of the Drought Contingency Plan Steering Committee got drafts of the legislation as well. And if you remember, there are about 40 people on that steering committee, and only about four of them are lawmakers. The rest of them represent, you know, various water users or water interests. So you have the ag community developers, you have a representative from the governor's office, you have municipalities like the city of Phoenix, and so on and so forth. So all of them are also very interested in what that legislation has to say.
I'm sure they don't just have something to say, but something to add, perhaps, to this legislation or remove. People are going to want to make changes of some kind. What's the process from here, and what are you hearing from lawmakers in particular about what we expect in these next steps?
I will say that the water folks at the Department of Water Resources and Central Arizona Projects, the two groups that have really been leading this DCP charge, really tried to keep the legislation basic. And the reason why is they didn't want people coming in at the last minute and saying, oh, we don't like this line, you have to take this out. We don't like this piece of legislation, you have to take it out. And then the whole deal falling apart on January 30th because of that. So the legislation is really just like a broad overlook. I mean, the main thing is that there is a joint resolution that allows the Department of Water Resources Director Tom Buschotsky to sign on to this multi-state drought contingency plan. And then there are about six other measures, or maybe five other measures, that deal with the interstate agreement, and part of it allocates money, $30 million to go to the Colorado River Indian tribes for lands that they're going to fallow and water they're not going to use, and then $5 million to Pinal County farmers who are going to be resorting to more groundwater infrastructure to make up for the fact that they're using less Colorado River water, and they too will also have to fallow a significant portion of their lands over the next few years to make up for the cuts in water. So what lawmakers are sort of saying about this, I think it's early in the process. It's definitely early in the process. And you have to remember that water is such a complicated topic that most of these lawmakers, unless they've been there a while or unless they've dealt with water policy before, are starting from square one or maybe square two after the Water 101 briefings. So they probably took the long weekend to look over the legislation and maybe talk to some of their constituents and some of the water users or main water users in their districts and gauge their opinions. The thing I will say, though, is that the legislation looked like it was promised to look. So I'm sure somebody will have a problem with it. I'm sure somebody will make a big stink about it. But here's the thing. This is about what people have been expecting. From my initial glance at it, I didn't see anything that really popped up or stood out as something that would stir controversy or create a fight. So I'm sure we'll hear more from lawmakers in the coming weeks. But Katie, you talked to a couple of them last week, and they had some thoughts on the early draft legislation.
Yeah, I had a chance to catch up with House Minority Leader Representative Charlene Fernandez as she was taking a bus ride out to Yuma last week and get her first thoughts on that draft legislation. And she said essentially what you said, that this looks about right, that it, you know, on the whole, it's okay. That was the word she used. It's okay. This is what we were expecting. But her caucus did see several red flags, and I'm using air quotes there. In particular, she was hoping to see more conservation measures. And when she says that, she means things that they can actually measure in terms of conservation. Otherwise, she's afraid we're going to end up back in this exact same situation a decade from now and looking back and going, what the heck did we do wrong? The other flag that she mentioned relates back to what you were just discussing about Pinal County and the groundwater use. Their fear, they being the Democrats, is that we have this infrastructure in place to utilize that groundwater, but that it's been neglected for years and that it's basically compromised. It's not good anymore and we need new infrastructure. And the Pinal County agriculture community has pointed out something similar. They had a press conference last week touching on degrading infrastructure and the need for reliable wells and pipelines to ensure that they have access to that groundwater. And that's something Representative Fernandez echoed, that they want to ensure that that infrastructure is there to actually get the job done. Like you said, though, whether these are actual sticking points that would make this legislation not pass, I very seriously doubt that. But it is something that will likely come up as we hear legislators talk more about what they've actually seen. I think, though, the resounding response has probably been, at least we have something to see. House Speaker Bowers had told me before seeing the draft legislation, we can't sign on to something without seeing it. Essentially, he was afraid the devil was in the details and that lawmakers were going to get hung up in understanding this very complicated issue and then voting on something. And while the governor didn't say you have to do it, he's made it clear he wants a deal. Now they've got legislation on the table. The deal needs to be done. It's just a matter of who gets caught up on what. And on that note, I want to go back to something you said before about this is the early stages of this process before the lawmakers. And that is true, but it is the early stages of a very short process. We cannot say enough that the federal deadline on this is January 31st. I think I've asked you this before, Carmen. Are we going to meet the deadline?
I'm feeling optimistic at this point, and I think the reason for that is because the governor said it's going to get done, and lawmakers have legislation. So who really wants to be the one to drop the ball at this point, especially when this is a multi-state deal? And whoever does drop the ball, it's going to look bad on Arizona as a whole, which I guess reflects on the governor, which could be why he's pushing it so hard. But then if it's, you know, the Republican caucus in the House or the Democratic caucus in the Senate that totally drops the ball on this, then I feel like the governor's going to come out swinging and just shame them relentlessly. But I will go back to the fact that this has been a months-long process. This has been going on for ages. People have talked and talked and talked, and I cannot believe that there can be that much more to talk about. So it's time to just sort of put up or shut up, and they have until January 31st to sign on to the multi-state DCP, and I lost my count of days. I think it's definitely less than 2 weeks at this point. So we're going to see this move pretty quickly through the legislature, and then my guess is you'll see a vote on January 31st.
I think we're at 12, maybe 12 days. Don't quote me on that, folks. Quote the governor. Carmen, I bet when you moved out here from the East Coast that you wouldn't be coming to the desert to be an expert on water. But here you are, and we're so happy we have you.
Thanks. I'm glad I'm a quick learner, I guess, question mark.
It's
still complicated. I still have so many questions.
And if you still have questions and we haven't answered them, you know where to find us, folks. Let us know what's on your mind. There's about a million other things on our minds. Unfortunately, this session doesn't just end at January 31st with a resolution on the DCP and other water legislation. There are so many other priorities yet to tackle. And we had a lovely budget meeting at the governor's office on Friday to go over some of those priorities that are actually going to get some money. We'll be back with reporter Ben Giles after the break to talk about what those priorities are. Hey, Politicos. You know you can always rely on our team to bring you the news you need to stay up to date on what's going on at the Capitol. But on January 29th, you can also hear directly from the legislative leadership on the big issues of the 2019 session. Get the big picture at the first Morning Scoop of the year on January 29th at Alexi's Grill. Tickets can be purchased online at azcapitoltimes.com. That's azcapitoltimes.com. Welcome back to The Breakdown. I'm your host, Katie Campbell, and I'm here now with reporter Ben Giles. Ben, water wasn't the only thing taking up our time last week. On Friday, we got a first look at the governor's executive budget. There were a lot of highlights in there, but what would you say was the most outstanding detail?
Well, Katie, while the federal government is busy furloughing its employees and not paying them at all, Doug Ducey wants to give roughly half of Arizona's state workforce a pay bump. And that varies depending on what you do and what agency you work for. But overall, what we're looking at is a proposal for 45%. That's roughly 15,000 of the state's more than 30,000 employees would see a pay increase if Ducey gets his way in the budget. Most of that is targeted towards law enforcement type officials. We're talking about corrections officers at the Department of Corrections. We're talking about highway patrol with the Department of Public Safety. At agencies like DCS, it's caseworkers, but it's also folks who are AZ post-certified law enforcement professionals. And that extends to a host of other agencies, things like parks. That's where you're going to see Ducey's focus. And the way the ninth floor pitched it on Friday was, we're trying to get more money to the folks who kind of quote unquote put their life on the line. That's the class of professional at the Arizona state level that they're trying to increase funds for.
And also some 5% raises for those non-sworn individuals at departments like the Parks Department and a couple of others in there. You can get the full details of how that breaks down through a link on our story at azcapitaltimes.com. But Ben, let's talk about some of those other big details that were included in the budget, starting with education. What sort of initiatives does the governor want to see through and throw some money at?
Well, the first thing that he's setting out to do is to fulfill the promise of that 20 by 2020 pay raise. That was a 10% raise in the fiscal 2019 budget. And if he's going to follow through, he needs to hike teacher pay again by 5% this year and 5% in the budget that they'll work on in 2020. The budget that he's proposed does do that. It does increase teacher pay. It also does increase incrementally by about, I think, $68 million, the restoration of district additional assistance, those extra flexible spending dollars that school districts have, which they kind of encourage them to use for teacher pay, but not necessarily does it have to go to that. So that's the kind of the baseline for education. There are new initiatives, though, and that is highlighted with funding for school maintenance and construction and funding for high-performing schools. Let's first talk about maintenance. There's a supplemental appropriation of about $25 million and a one-time expense of, I want to say, $60 million or so in the upcoming budget year. And that would cover requests to the school facilities board for maintenance fixes, for just kind of upkeep at some of our schools. The funding that's provided, by the way, the governor's office said it would ensure that every request that they've gotten in 2018 and 2019, every request would be able to be fulfilled. So all the schools would get their needs covered. Moving forward, too, the governor wants to go back to the old way of doing things as far as new school construction, and that is to actually try and anticipate based on the projections of the student body when you're going to need a new school and to have it built in time to meet that need. In 2013, one of the recession era changes under the Brewer administration was to basically say, we're not going to build you a new school until you're bursting at the seams. That's a problem because what do you do for the 2 or 3 years it takes to build a school while you don't have the capacity to host all your students? They're going to try and move away from that and already are looking ahead to 2020, 2021, and 2022 in about 6 school districts where they see a need in the future and they're going to fund the school construction now.
You also mentioned performance-based funding. What changes are we seeing there?
There's some pretty dramatic changes to that model, which is something the governor has pushed throughout his time in the ninth floor. What you're seeing this year is a dramatic increase in funding, about a 60 million or so increase to a total of $98 million for that program. And there's a need there because they're changing the criteria for what they determine to be a high-performing school. Right now, the AZ merit test has been the judgment for whether or not you get those funds or not. That can't really be the scale going forward because not all high schools are going to use the AZ merit test. There's now a so-called menu of assessments. You can't see it, but I'm using air quotes, that basically high schools can use any number of tests to try and gauge student attainment and student learning. So going forward, performance-based funding models will use the A to F letter grades that are assigned by the Board of Education and the Department of Education. And what that means is A schools will get funding and some B schools will get funding. Now, a part of the performance-based model is that low-income schools get more dollars. So for those A schools, if you have a student body that 60% or more of it is on free and reduced lunch, which is traditionally something that happens in a low-income school area, you're going to get $400 extra per pupil. If you don't have that many students on free or reduced lunch, you're looking at $225 million. For B schools, the only B schools that would get it are those that hit that 60% threshold, and they would get $225 million. The ninth floor estimates that with this new standard, about half the schools in the state would qualify for this funding. And the neat thing about it is, I suppose, is that it doesn't necessarily have to all go to that school. So you could have a school district with 10 schools, one school that's an A school. The program demands that at least 51% of that extra per pupil funding goes to the school, the site that earned it. But you could spread the other 49% throughout the district. And that they're pitching as a way to help uplift other schools so that more schools are A and B schools and more schools might qualify for this funding in the future.
Yeah, and on that note, they're actually going to install some additional reporting requirements as far as where that results-based funding money actually goes. Is that right?
That's right. Now, we don't know what those requirements are going to mean yet. That's something that's got to get worked out legislatively. But what that does mean is they recognize there's a significant chunk of change now that's going to this. And the schools that are impacted, I mean, I think it's 285 schools or so that are in the program right now. It's going to be 985 or so schools in the program next year. That's a lot of schools, and they want to make sure they know where the money's going. They want to know how it's being spent. The idea being they want to be able to track so-called best practices to see what's working in high-performing schools and hopefully to replicate that elsewhere, not just in that district, but in other struggling districts.
Well, speaking of reporting, Ducey also wants to completely fulfill a request from the State Board for Charter Schools in terms of additional personnel, which would include 3 financial auditors, 6 academic auditors, and 1 audit manager. Tell us about that.
Well, this is where the rubber meets the road, I guess, for the governor's efforts to try and bring about some more transparency and accountability to charter schools. He's heard the drumbeat about that for not just last year, but for years now. And the charter board did request more personnel. They said, we're not getting to enough schools as often enough. There's about a 23% visitation rate as far as on-site visits from auditors to charter schools right now. Now, that's sort of in line with the schedules that are required by law for the financial and academic performance audits that these schools are required to undergo. But what that means is there's not necessarily boots on the ground in the event that the charter board notices something fishy or there's something might be wrong, it's hard for them right now to get out and take a look on site. This is going to supposedly dramatically increase the amount of on-site visits. They'll have to about 65% of those more than 500 charters each year. And that actually is a pretty small cost in the as far as the grand scheme of things in the budget. It's more than $700,000 for those 10 positions. I would expect there to be some fights for more funding, perhaps, than even the charter board had asked for. With that small an amount, a small increase could dramatically increase the number of auditors they could hire. But behind the scenes, too, there's also going to be debates about functionally what kind of duties do those auditors have and what are they really looking for at charter schools? And more importantly, what are the charter schools required to turn over and to report to them? Those are the types of the debates that are going to have a real impact on charters and accountability going forward.
Also in the education realm, but also public safety / school safety, we've got proposed dollars in the budget for school resource officers, as well as school counselors or social workers, depending on what districts request. What kind of money are we looking at in both those buckets?
So as far as cops and schools go, we're looking at a $9 million budget, at least what the governor is offering. And that harkens back to something that he said during his State of the State address, which was, we're going to have a cop in every school. Now, the follow-through on that sentence was every school that wants one. It's not a mandate that the school has to have a resource officer on campus. But right now, the governor's office says there's about 89 unfulfilled requests for SROs from 89 schools. $9 million is going to cover the cost of salary and benefits and training and equipment for those officers. And they're expecting that that's going to be a need that will grow. You know, if you're not fulfilling a request, that probably artificially deflates the number of requests that you're getting, because why bother if they're not being fulfilled? There's a likelihood that if this goes through, they're probably going to need more money in the future for that program. On the flip side, we've heard a lot about the counselor to student ratio, something like 900-1 in Arizona. The governor is proposing $6 million in grant funding that schools could use either for counselors or social workers. Now, the salaries for those two positions can vary greatly, but assuming every school that requested money from this program wanted a counselor, that would be about 120 counselors that could be hired across the state. And they're anticipating that that would greatly diminish the caseload or, again, that counselor to student ratio.
So those are some pretty big ticket items that are in Ducey's executive budget. But there was something that was noticeably missing from what he laid out. What was that, Ben?
That would be tax conformity. And that's not necessarily missing because it's not of importance to the governor's office, but it's missing because they say they have no idea what the impact of tax conformity will be. Now, there are estimates. The Department of Revenue has put out numbers that suggest there could be a windfall for the state. The Joint Legislative Budget Committee, their analysts have suggested it could be a windfall somewhere in the realm of $130 million. And they've kind of simultaneously stood by that estimate, but also noted that we might not know what we're talking about. There's just no way to tell how much money the state could gain in new revenues if they conform to the federal tax code without any effort to ensure that it's a net neutral confirmation and Arizonans won't be paying more in taxes. So it's the governor's office just wants to avoid the issue of trying to be net neutral. And instead, what they're saying is, we're going to conform the way we always do. They're urging taxpayers to take the documents that they've got from DOR, if you've gotten those already, start filing your taxes. If something goes crazy, there are provisions to hold taxpayers harmless if something changes after they file. But generally, their idea is, let's just not try and guess what it's going to be. Let's just conform as we have historically. And if there is a windfall, we're going to put it into the rainy day fund. Now, that would be on top of the $542 million that they already want to put into the rainy day fund. That would be a deposit from the general fund, a one-time expense. That would get us up to the $1 billion, a 9% cap, so to speak, on the rainy day fund. But it could be even more than that, depending on tax conformity and however the Ninth Floor and Republican legislators and Democrats, too, can figure that one out.
And just really quickly to clarify, to get to that 9% cap that they're proposing, they would need a change in current state law. As it stands, the rainy day fund cannot exceed 7% of the general fund. So what change exactly are they looking for?
So it's a pretty simple statutory change. Just to clarify, $1 billion is equal to about 9% of estimated general fund revenues. They actually want to lift the cap up to 10%, and that would give them some wiggle room, I suppose, if there is a windfall from tax conformity. But it's really just a matter of going back into statute and changing a 7 to a 10. And they're not proposing any other changes, so the rainy day fund would still function similarly to the way it has in the past, which is that if you hit that cap, whether it's at 7% or 10%, the treasurer's office is required to transfer the excess money in the rainy day fund back to the general fund. Historically, the idea there, the Ninth Floor said, is it doesn't really look good to squirrel away so much money. But they point to Moody's, they point to the Pew Charitable Trust, and they point to the Treasurer's Office, which all issued reports before a Senate Appropriations Committee last week that said the state hasn't saved enough, and $1 billion would be a better bet to help survive at least the first couple of years of a recession.
Well, that's what it might take to survive the next couple of years if a recession hits. But right now, what I'm concerned with, what you're probably concerned with, Ben, is just surviving 2019. So what I'm hearing here is plenty of things to fight about between the governor's office and the legislature, although they insist that we're not going to fight, and I hope we don't. We can just get through it maybe 100 days. But for that, you're going to have to come back next week to hear where exactly these conversations are and what legislators want to do with all of that money. Of course, we only have so much time to lay out for you what we saw in the executive budget last week. If you want to know more, go to azcapitaltimes.com, see the wonderful story Ben and Carmen Foreman wrote, check out Legislative Report and the Yellow Sheet Report. I know they're expensive people, but they've got all of the wonderful tidbits you're probably looking for.
I work my tail off on Legislative Report. You should probably subscribe and, you know, help me pay rent.
Yes, help us pay rent, make us feel relevant, all of that fun stuff that you readers love to do. And of course, you can come back and just listen to this podcast for free next week on The Breakdown.
Thank you.